really staff, my crack staff, just this morning, they were, oh, yeah, we forgot to do the press release, because normally they try to crank something, because I hate press releases. But I said, that one I'll go along with, you know, but they forgot to do it.
Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement meeting will come to order. Quorum is present. First item on the agenda, Senator Larson, approval of the August 12th minutes. Representative Larson moves that the minutes be adopted as printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendments are adopted. Second item on the agenda is the continuing conversation about the mandated study of teacher retirement benefits and other plan benefits, especially for those people that were hired after 1989, and what should be included, what things in particular should be included into the plans. We have not yet heard from the School Boards Association or the League of Cities, and they are here today prepared to tell us a little bit about how they look at retirement and where their money comes from to pay their share of the employees' retirement plans. And there's also, I understand, Mr. Haveman from the Taxpayers Association that we asked for a little more information about the letter that was sent from the Taxpayers Association. I understand that he is here today, too. So we're going to start with the presentation from the School Boards Association. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Schwab.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name for the record is Grace Kelleher. I got married 26 days ago, and I now have 7 children. So for the record,
holy cow!
We're pro-education at my house.
Kelleher?
Kelleher, K-E-L-I-H-E-R.
Oh. Well, congratulations, and I don't know how that got by me.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm here today to express some of our concerns and give you some of the examples of how retirement pensions impact our school districts. And there's really some simple points we'd like you to keep in mind as you move forward. But basically, school districts cannot levy for any pension increase, per se. Though, as the cities and the counties have, we are not. This last year, though, you did give us the authority to bond for other pension employee benefits. Those would be the health benefits. And a lot of school districts are doing that around the state. But for the simple increase or employer match, there is no way to get those funds into our programs. The second thing we'd like you to think about, too, is we really feel the need to fully fund what we've got in place for our employees before we add new benefits. We want to make sure that retirement they've counted on all their life is there when they retire, and that's really a priority with us that's available. And lastly, we asked the Pension Committee to consider all the retirement options and salary benefits, 403B, that our employees get. We just don't think looking at one slice of the pie is a good way to compare items as we go forward. And I promised you that was the last one, but I have to add one more. We are going to need teachers in the state of Minnesota desperately soon. We're going to start to see our baby boomers retire, and we will be desperate to find teachers. And I ask you to keep that in mind. If we make retirement look too good, it's going to make us really scramble around the state to find highly qualified, competent teachers to teach our kids. So I hope you help us with that hurdle. We'd like to give, you know, we'd like to give them recognition and compensation as a pension, but if it looks too good, they might leave us, and it's going to really leave the kids in Minnesota in a bind. And I promised an example. It came across my desk last week, and it came from my old school district of Albert Lea, Minnesota. And they have in their contract some really benign language that says we will match the federal set-aside. Let me get the right word here. I might need some help with what this is called, but there's a set-aside, a retirement set-aside that really, it presently is at $2,500 for retirement that the district can match. That amount is going up by state law to $7,500. In the Albert Lea contract with their employees, they just said we will match the amount set in law. Well, they have just realized that keeping up with that language in their contract is going to cost them over $400,000. And in a small district, that's a lot of money to suddenly jump in cost. So I suggest by that example, districts aren't always the best at figuring out pension benefits. They vary significantly across the state, and there are ramifications to everything you folks do here that impact our local districts.
Ms. Keller, the Albert Lea School District, the 700 or the what's in state law or what's in law, is that what the contract said, what is in law? And it didn't say federal law or state law.
It said it would match that contribution. And, you know, you don't think jumping from 2,500 to 700 and 7,500 is a big jump, but when you add all your employees onto it, it's very significant, and they really are left with no way to do it but take it out of their general ed. There's no other money in a school district. So when you face those kinds of pension issues, unlike my good friends the cities and the counties, we have to look at our budget and say, where's that money coming from? And it just makes any increase more difficult for us to handle. And there's lots of ways to look at that. You could give us levy authority for it, similar to how the cities and counties have. There could be, you know, a stream of revenue for that, but it would make sense that you would treat all local governments the same. Mm-hmm. So in the end, we've sort of got the short end of the stick.
And we didn't realize it as we were going through the process.
Madam Chairman, that's correct. I think that we might find that also popping up at other school districts around the state, depending on their contractual language.
Ms. Keller, do you know how many school districts estimate the amount of money that they need for their share of the retirement benefits and then put it aside at the beginning of the budgeting process rather than at the end of the budgeting process?
Madam Chairman, I know of a couple firsthand who do that. Osseo School District has always done it, and there's one other metropolitan district, I can assure you. I know places like Greenway, which has had a horrible, difficult time, struggles with that whole issue, so it's foremost in their mind. I don't have any data, though, to share with you that could support that. I would certainly not say by any means 50% of the school districts do that. I think they sort of start with their classroom needs first and build the budget out from there. And once again, when dollars are really short, the ability to cover increases gets more and more difficult for districts.
I have a newspaper article, too, from the Cloquet Journal that says, school board contemplates bond sale for retiree benefits. This is predominantly, I guess, health insurance stuff, but are more school districts talking about doing this now than before the tax bill allowed them to do it, but have school districts been saying for years, oh, we should be able to bond for our retirement benefits, or do they see that as something that they're going to get into trouble with?
Well, Madam Chairman, I would tell you my school districts don't like to get into trouble at all. The item you're talking about could be two things, and the second just occurred to me. We have 21 districts in the state of Minnesota, mostly from the range area, northern Minnesota, that have the ability to do limited bonding. So that's just a piece for their retirement benefits. Across the state last year, school districts along with cities and counties were granted the authority to cover their other their OPEB costs, other pension employee benefits. And there are quite a few districts that are taking that opportunity and going forward to cover those. But as with every local government, I mean, and you all know very, very well that there is a catch with the public. If you know, go willy-nilly and you raise everything at once, the public is going to oust you. They're going to froth, and you're going to run into a lot of trouble. So I think the same things that make cities and counties very thoughtful about that would also make school districts thoughtful about how they use that authority if granted by the legislature.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much for your insights, and we will definitely speak with you again.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Finn from the League of Cities, would you come and give us some advice on things that we can contemplate in putting our study together?
Madam Chair and members, good morning. My name is Ann Finn, and I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. I do have some handouts going around. I know that was one of the things that the Chair requested, and I certainly won't go through them in any detail today, but they may be useful to you as you begin this undertaking. Essentially, the way that cities address pension costs is by property taxes, and we do have very limited options when it comes to the funding. And again, the bulk comes from property taxes, and then we also have access to some local government aid in some cases, and police and fire state aid. I want to note that, and I'm sure you all know this, but cities do not have authority to increase employer or employee contributions because they are set in state statute. I did also want to note that, as Ms. Kelleher alluded to, the 2008 legislature did carve out in the omnibus tax bill police and fire wage and benefit increases from levy limits. And so there is some flexibility there when it comes to paying for pension benefits for police and fire employees, but again, if those are increased in any amount, it would also fall back to the property tax. Another question that the staff sent along to me was what kind of role pension funding plays in the budgeting process at the city level. Essentially, pensions are a fixed expenditure, so cities need to meet their pension contribution obligations before most other services are funded. That means before they fill the potholes, before they upgrade their equipment, before they implement any kind of recreational programming, they need to make sure that those other items in their budget are taken care of. And so the only way then that a city could reduce the cost of these benefits would be to reduce staff, reduce hours, or reduce wages. You asked if the League has any printed material that we send out to our members about how to deal with pension costs. And the main item that we send is this top item in the handout today. It's this budget guide. And beginning on page 30 of that handout, you'll see a pretty descriptive section about what cities need to do in order to make sure that their budget costs are fixed into their pension costs are fixed into their budgets. And this, I think, is very widely used. We have over 830 member cities, and this goes to everybody, and they do really rely on this document when it comes to setting their budgets each year. So you'll see what they get from us in the way of instructions on funding their pension benefits. We also, Madam Chair and members, do a lot of outreach with our members about pension contributions and try and keep them abreast of what's going on both at PERA and with this commission. You'll see a variety of handouts with the materials I gave you today, one being something we sent out before the legislative session this year. It's our city's magazine, one of the main articles here is about paying for pensions. There's also another piece in that same handout about rehiring retirees, and that's something I had planned on talking about later in my comments today. But we do try and get people thinking about what's going on, and that helps us when we come here to talk to you about, you know, our idea of the solution, or, you know that we've supported bills in the past in order to take corrective actions for the funds. And that comes when we come to you with our position on those things. It's after having spoken with our members and delivering information to them. I also want to compliment Mary Vanek from PERA. She's been wonderful about coming to the league, presenting to our policy committees, keeping our members informed about what's going on with the plans, so that when we come down here, we can get the buy-in we need from them to give you good information. Finally, you asked what are current and future city employment and workforce issues, and I think we all know that the workforce is changing dramatically, and it is for cities just as it is in other public sector jobs and places of work, as well as in the private sector. Statistically, the public sector has an older average workforce. And already we are starting to see, as baby boomers are thinking about retiring, some shortages of employees in certain fields. Specific ones that our HR director at the league shared with me, their cities are beginning to see a shortage of engineers. They are also having difficulty recruiting and retaining volunteer firefighters. And those are probably just early indicators of what's to come with other kinds of jobs at the city level as well. We expect that the full force of this is about 5 years away as more baby boomers retire, and we are trying to help our members kind of start thinking about that and do some workforce planning so that as people retire, we can find ways to either fill their jobs or find folks who can come in and do the job on a part-time basis so that we have someone in those positions. I should note that there has been some moderation of this trend just based on the economy as well as the high cost of health insurance, and we're seeing people that want to stay on a little bit longer so that they can keep those health insurance benefits, or they want to make sure that they have a few more years to save before they retire given the instability in the economy. Cities also have traditionally tried to use their workforce very creatively. A couple examples of this, I know some cities bring back retired police officers to do intake at their front desks, perhaps on a part-time basis. We also have, in many communities, public works employees that are serving as volunteer firefighters. So they have permission from their employer to leave during the day to do those other jobs. At the present time, we are working with PERA to see if we can find some ways to provide more flexibility for cities to do things like phasing retirement or to have a more smooth transition when we want to rehire retirees. And the idea there being that they could work and provide valuable experience and service without compromising their pension benefits. Finally, I just wanted to make a few general comments, and this came out of some conversations I had preparing for today. We want to note that local government employers and employees depend on a financially sound pension plan. We know that just from the experience from our HR directors that sound pension plans are one reason that people are attracted to the public sector. And long-term employment benefits help employers attract and retain qualified and talented employees. And compared to the private sector, we believe that public pension plans in Minnesota are adequate and can be a tool for keeping the public sector workforce strong. The bottom line is that we really don't need incentives for people to leave sooner. So we want the pension plans to be whole, but we do need to keep those employees given the changes in the workforce. And we'd like for people to be able to stay on with us and provide their talents and skills as long as they're willing to do so. Finally, I want to end by complimenting you on making some difficult decisions in recent years to keep the plans financially sustainable. I think it could have been maybe easier for you to make some short-term fixes and hold on to hope that market changes would eliminate the need for corrective actions. but instead you've swallowed some bitter medicine, as have some of the public employees and employers, when it comes to things like contribution increases for the PERA coordinated and police and fire plans. You've made difficult changes to the line of duty disability retirement benefits for public safety officials, and you've also just recently in 2008 taken some corrective action dealing with the post fund. We know that that wasn't easy, and again, it wasn't easy for us to sell it to our members either, but we appreciate you taking tough actions to ensure the viability of Minnesota's pension plans. With that, I think I'll stop here and take any questions that you have. I'm sorry for the length of the comments, but I hope the handouts will be helpful to you as well.
You bet. Thank you so much. It was very comprehensive, and you answered all my questions. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Could I ask a minute or two worth of background questions on the league? How many cities are in... Does there exist in the state of Minnesota, and how many of those cities are members of the League of Minnesota Cities?
Certainly, Madam Chair and Representative Smith, there are at present, I believe, 854 cities in Minnesota, and of those, about 825 are members. Those that are not members of the League of Cities are generally, I think we have no city that doesn't belong that is over 200 in population. In other words, those 30 or so cities that don't belong to the league are very small, and they sometimes call us with questions, and we treat them as members in terms of providing information.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
That's virtually all the cities, it sounds like. Remind me what total amount on a yearly basis or biennial is the amount of dues paid by these cities to the group?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I don't have the answer for that question, but I would be happy to get that to you. I do know that it's on a sliding scale based on the population of the city.
Madam Chair, a couple more questions, and that is, you mentioned some creative ways that cities are using either retired staff or active staff. One of the cities in my house district saw a rather creative way of using an active city personnel. The individual is a public works director, and he ran for and was elected to the city council. So he's got two jobs. He's working for the city, and he's on the council making decisions on spending issues. But that's beside the point. I'm curious, how many of the 854 cities in Minnesota have a similar situation where they've got a city employee who's also a member of their city council? Do you know?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I don't know. But I can tell you that I've only heard of a couple of situations like that, with the exception of, I know there are council members throughout the state serving as firefighters in some cases, or volunteer fire relief. Volunteer firefighters. But for someone as a department head or even a local government employee to serve on the council, I would say is very unusual.
Well, Madam Chair, would you have the ability to go back to the office and punch a computer button and find out the answer? Because I am curious.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'll do everything I can to get that information to you.
Very good. Madam Chair, one last question, and that is, I do appreciate as well the written documents you've given and your presentation. A lot of professions have continuing courses. For example, attorneys have to go through several credits of continuing legal education to maintain their licenses. Do city managers have any continuing education they have to go through, and or do you make these kinds of presentations or an effort to make these kinds of presentations to city managers and city councils in the state?
Ms. Finn.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, they do have a professional association, but I don't believe there are any continuing education requirements of city managers. We have a whole department at the League of Cities that is dedicated to training and conferences that's coordinated with our loss control folks, and they go out to different regions of the state and offer coursework on different issues. But again, it's not required, and so the folks who are attending those sessions do so based on their own interest or at the urging of their city elected officials.
Thank you.
Thank you. Those were thought-provoking questions, Representative Smith.
Well, Madam Chair, it is. And since we do mandate continuing classwork for some professions, it seems where we directly have an input into cities, they're creatures of the state anyway, might be something to look at down the line.
Of course, to be a city manager or a city administrator, they don't even have to have a particular degree, though, do they, Ms. Spin?
Madam Chair, no, they don't. And, you know, I think also one thing worth noting is that the qualifications and the responsibilities of the executive officer of an individual city vary dramatically. I mean, we've heard of city clerks working out of their own basements in very small cities, and then we know that we have some very elaborate city halls in our larger cities where the manager has very extensive responsibilities. So that would make it difficult to do something to require any training, but certainly we'd be willing to work with you on any ideas you have in terms of making sure folks are qualified to serve.
Ms. Finn, when you're looking up those city employees that are also on the councils, if there's any instances of problems that have occurred in those positions, I would be interested.
Madam Chair, could I add to that question?
Sure.
I would hope you've got a computer that can get all this information at some point. By trouble, I don't know what I don't know what Madam Chair is looking for there, but I would suspect some of the trouble would be has any city gotten into a lawsuit over it, either by one of the citizens, and or another question might be, has any of the cities required that city employee to suspend or terminate their city employment if they chose to go on the city council? I suppose those would be a couple areas of trouble that I'd be interested in as well.
Thank you. Anything else? Thanks, Ms. Finn.
Thank you.
And as we go through the printed materials, if anything else comes up, I bet she's going to be back at another meeting so we can ask continued questions then. All right. I asked the Association of Counties also to be here, but they were not available for this meeting. Mr. Havman? Thank you for coming today. And we had your letter at the last meeting, and Mr. Twait stood and came down and addressed the letter, but didn't feel that he wanted to talk for the association. And so we welcome you and seek your advice.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Mark Haven. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to talk about our interests in this in the scope of this study before you. We do applaud the Commission for embarking on this process. We think it's an important activity you are investing in here, and we share your interest in designing a defined benefit system that meets the needs of teachers and other public employees while avoiding undue harm to the school finance system and exposing taxpayers to unnecessary risk with respect to unfunded liabilities. Our primary concern with respect to the scope of the study centers around ensuring that the discussions of adequacy are placed in a broader public finance context. There is a lot of attention likely to be devoted to very technical dimensions, such as multipliers and things of that nature, that are an important part of this study. However, we feel that those issues also must be placed in a broader set of issues and understanding with respect to how these systems work within the public finance system of the states that have them. Let me give you one specific example of the types of things that we might be concerned about. The Citizens Research Council of Michigan published a report recently looking at Michigan public school employee retirement system, and they concluded that in fiscal year 2005, the increase in contributions will average approximately $90 per pupil, an amount greater than the entire per pupil increase in school aid support. In the following three fiscal years, the average per pupil increase in contributions will exceed $100 per year. In fiscal year 2008, the per pupil cost of contributions will average about $1,200. Now, you know, I have absolutely no idea where from a technical dimension, how the benefits system of the state of Michigan would compare to Minnesota. And I also have no idea whether or not this issue is a function of unsustainable benefits design, pure contribution policies that the state of Michigan may have had in previous years, poor investment returns, or a combination of all three. The point is that we think that all of that needs to be examined together in context to have an understanding of what's going on here, because if we just do a simple benchmark comparison of what the teachers say in the state of Michigan get with respect to their benefits design compared to Minnesota, I think you can see that maybe some important information may be missing with respect to the short and long-term implications of that benefit design on public finance in the state of Michigan, or the state of Minnesota in our case. So in summary, I guess we would encourage that in some way these other issues are brought into the analysis to ensure that it's not just the technical dimensions of the benefits design are at issue, but also having a better understanding of how this intricate web of relationships actually works, and ensuring that the state of Minnesota embarks on a strategy that meets all those needs.
Mr. Habeman, has your association discussed the thing that we have, the people that the public employees that are working for us now that were hired before 1989, and the group of people that's continuing to rise that were hired after 1989 that have different benefits from the people before 1989? Have you discussed that and the differences, and if there's any merit in bringing the after 89 people up to what the before 1989 people have?
We have not, Madam Chair, we have not delved into that issue per se. When there was a proposal before this commission, and actually I believe was introduced on the floor, that had a teacher benefit increase, we did some quick back-of-the-envelope calculations with respect to what the implications may be for school finance. With regards to the sort of ongoing equity issues and concerns, no, we haven't addressed that in any particular detail.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. At a later time, we are going to have some finance people, education finance people, here to talk to us about this, maybe on the same day that the demographer comes. The next is an addition, and it pertains to the benefit adequate study, so it fits right in. And that item is from Mr. Thompson at TRA, and Ms. Hacking, the National Institute on Retirement Security Study, and they have the information is in our packets, and I bet we all haven't read it completely, and so we're going to take let's have a brief introduction, Ms. Vanek and Mr. Bergstrom too, to set this up for us, and so how the information will fit into the things that we have to consider in our study. Measuring the economic benefits and a better bang for the buck.
Okay. We actually have, Madam Chair, Laurie Hacking with TRA. We have actually two pieces of information to provide. We'll start with a better bang for the buck and then segue to a more local study that we've done here in Minnesota about the economic impact of pensions on the state, the public pensions. I think in your... In your folders, you have something that's very brief. I'm going to go through this. It looks like this. It's just a few slides, and I'll go through briefly the highlights of the report. First of all, the report was prepared by the National Institute on Retirement Security, which is a relatively new organization. It's been around only about a year, and it is an organization that's dedicated to research on pension issues, and particularly trying to improve retirement security for all workers, public as well as private sector. This recent report we think you would find interesting because at your last hearing you discussed a lot about the preference for defined benefit plans, and it's a principle of the Commission to support our defined benefit structure. So this is relevant because it shows you what the economic impacts or efficiencies are of defined benefit plans as compared to defined contribution. In summary, what this study tried to do was evaluate the costs of delivering the same benefit, which in this case is about $2,200 a month, the same benefit under a defined benefit structure versus a defined contribution structure, and to evaluate the differential costs using either of those structures. What the study found is that the defined benefit approach saves costs for three reasons, and I'll go over each in some detail. One, and the biggest impact, is longevity pooling, that is the risk of outliving your assets, to be brief about it. Secondly, that defined benefit plans have a better diversified portfolio, investment portfolio, and basically do better at the rates of return that they gain relative to defined contribution plans. So if you turn the page, second page at the top, the calculation is that to fund a $2,200 a month benefit for average lifespan, it, for a defined benefit plan, takes about $355,000. That's a lump sum amount. And actually, it's very similar to the lump sum amount we transfer when we fund a teacher's pension benefit. And that includes a cost of living adjustment in this calculation. In order to fund that benefit, on average, it takes about 12.5% of payroll. Now, in teacher retirement, Minnesota's case, we actually have lower contributions than that right now, but in this calculation, it is a calculation of roughly 12.5% of pay. So the first strength of a defined benefit plan is this longevity risk pooling. Because we cover very large groups of retirees, we only have to pay out for the average life expectancy of large groups, whereas an individual in a defined benefit plan really has to plan for longer than that. And what in this study they are aiming for is they want, an individual is probably going to want a 90% chance of not outliving their assets. So that means instead of planning for an average lifespan to age 85, an individual is probably going to want to plan for something into the 90s in the event that they do live till that at that age. In fact, in this case, the plan is for 97, age 97, because it's at that age that you have a 90% chance of not running out of money. So because of this longer lifespan, it really individuals end up over-saving for themselves. Now, if they do predecease that age 97, of course, the assets do go to their heirs. But in defined benefit plans, that's not the case. We are just planning for the average life expectancy and don't have those additional ancillary benefits that would go to an estate. That's a huge impact. That longevity adds an additional over $100,000 to the costs of a defined contribution plan. The second strength of the defined benefit plan is that better portfolio diversification. Defined benefit plans have really infinite investment horizons and therefore don't really ever have to shift to more conservative portfolios. An individual does. As the individual ages, typically, and you see at the bottom of page 3 a display of this, they will shift, or most financial advisors will advise a shifting, moving assets from equities, stocks, and more into bonds. That greatly reduces the rate of return that those assets can earn. So that, too, has an effect, and it adds an additional $30,000 to this cost that we're discussing. And the third and final impact has to do with professional management of defined benefit assets. Because defined benefits are large, we get very, very good group asset pricing. We negotiate excellent fees. We don't have a lot of expenses for individual record keeping, education, or transactions. And most studies show that defined benefit plans earn between 1 to 2% per year better than defined contribution plan, individuals' defined contribution plan. So that also mounts up significantly and adds an additional $65,000 in this example. So, in sum, a defined benefit plan can basically deliver the same benefit for about 45% lower cost than a defined contribution plan. And that's summarized at the bottom of page 4 because of all those savings that I just enumerated. So, that's it. It's basically a better bang for the buck, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, and we'd also like to talk more specifically about economic impacts in Minnesota.
This dovetails well on our discussion from last time. I like that chart on page 7.
This report is brand new, so it just came out last Thursday. I thought it would be relevant to you.
The National Institute on Retirement Security is a nonprofit research institute established to contribute to informed policymaking. Do you know where they get their money from?
Yes. They are currently financed by three organizations, the Council of Institutional Investors, which is actually the largest contributor, National Association of State Retirement Administrators, and the National Council on Teacher Retirement. Those are the three sources of funds currently, although that's to really get the organization started. It is hopefully will be self-sustaining in the future through other sources of revenue, probably from retirement systems, both public and private, and also possibly foundation funding for research, but it's so new it's hard to know what its future sources are going to be. But currently, that's
what was the second one? National Council of Retired
Teacher Retirement, National Council of Teacher Retirement and National Association of State Retirement Administrators.
Like you guys?
Yes, like that. No. Exactly.
No. How many are there of the you guys?
There are
retired.
There are approximately nationwide. There are about between approximately 85 statewide pension systems. I think that's which belong to NASRA or NCTR. So there's about 80 to 90 large systems.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Let me ask a pointed question. So how do we know that this report is unbiased and not a sales tool of the contributors?
Good question. It's been vetted professionally by actuaries, by economists, and others. I think that the economic analysis is sound, and there have been others which look at it, and it's got to stand up to scrutiny. And quite frankly, having worked on some of this myself, the assumptions they're using are actually quite conservative. And I think they're, if anything, you could make an argument they're understating what the cost differential is. But if you read the report, some of the assumptions they make, they were trying to be cautious about not overblowing the results. So ultimately, it has to stand up to scrutiny. It's a public document. It's research. The individuals have put their names to it. So, and this organization wants to do more research. So, I think it's got a reason to be get off to a credible start.
We may have further questions about this report after we digest it more in light of our conversations and the advice that we've received. What about measuring the economic benefits?
Okay, Madam Chair and members.
It's all about Minnesota.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm Mary Vanek, PERA. I refer you to this document. It's a summary of a much more comprehensive study. We, the three retirement systems, contracted with an individual, Andrea Lubar, who has her doctorate degree in economics and who has done similar types of studies for university systems. We asked her to work in consultation with the Minnesota Department of Revenue Tax Incidence Study folks and the staff from the Department of Employment and Economic Development, who provided her with what's called the in-plan calculations and results. There, as I understand it, and I don't have a background in economics whatsoever, but there are two methods of measuring economic impact. And in-plan was used because the state of Minnesota already uses it. So you can compare the results of this study favorably with other studies that have been done by the Department of Economic Development. With the license to use this model, it was less costly than to use the RIMS model, which is the other typical model used for these types of studies. All I want to do is really point you to the key findings page. The rest of the document really spells out the details behind the key findings. And that is something that you are all familiar with, that among the three statewide plans, we serve nearly 500,000 people between our active participants, our deferred participants, and our benefit recipients. In Minnesota alone, we paid out $2.5 billion in fiscal year 2007 to people living here in Minnesota. We paid out $2.8 billion, but $2.5 stayed in Minnesota. In the analysis done by Dr. Lubov, she found that $2.2 billion actually went back into the economy, which provided an impact equivalent to $3.3 billion going back into Minnesota's economy through taxes, goods and services purchased. And she actually broke it down, as you will see in the report, by regions and by individual counties. So you can find that information both in the summary and in the more extensive report. Beneficiaries' spending was was determined to have provided 22,500 additional jobs statewide. And of those jobs, money put back, the taxes put back into the system generated, or the new jobs generated $791 million of growth in the state compared to about $701 million that was paid in employer contributions. So there was a gain to the state of roughly $80 million as a result of the taxes paid through those additional jobs and spending. The impact of benefits paid was larger than the gross state products attributable to several major economic sectors in Minnesota, including mining and air, rail, and water transportation. And a recent update to this study found that actually our impact was equivalent to 92% of the economic impact attributable to crop and animal production. We're an agricultural state, and our benefit impact was 92% equivalent to what that sector also provides the state. So the bottom line is what we found from this study is that currently the taxes collected, the revenue generated, exceeds the contributions paid by public and sector employers into our plans, and that we have a multiplier of about 1.5% that increases what's spent in the state over what we are paying out in actual benefits. So we felt pretty comfortable in sharing with you that we really do add a value to the lives and the economy of the state of Minnesota.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, on the key findings page, second bullet point, paying out $2.5 billion to 129,000 Minnesota residents in fiscal 07. Are there any recipients of the public systems paid out? Are there any recipients who are no longer living in Minnesota, and how do they factor into this 129,000 Minnesotans, and then how does that segue into $2.5 billion? What's the real number?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, about 90% of our participants pay taxes in Minnesota. So of the total payout that we have, 90% are Minnesota taxpayers.
Madam Chair, so the 90% who pay taxes, do they all live here as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, most of them would count this as their, by paying taxes, this would be their state of where they file homestead and where they file taxes. You know, obviously more go south in the winter, but a lot of people think, you know, Minnesotans flock the state, and the absolutely is not true. A lot of the others, the next closest I think is Wisconsin, and then we have the Dakotas as well, where a lot of our benefits go as well. But
Madam Chair,
Representative Smith,
on that page, $2.5 billion, is there a dollar amount over the $2.5 billion that is paid out to people not living here? And what is that number?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the total amount paid out in 2007 was $2.8 billion for all three systems. And of that, $2.5 billion went to residents in the state of Minnesota that are our benefit recipients.
Madam Chair, so then
Point three
went out of state.
Yes.
This is a question I am scratching my head over. How do you pay people $2.5 billion yet get $3.3 billion in effect over that?
Madam Chair,
Representative Mr. Bergstrom.
Smith, the impact then is they buy goods at a local store, buy gas, go to restaurants, pay taxes,
healthcare.
So that's kind of where the multiplier comes in. They don't just spend their money. They spend their money, and then that group spends their money as well. So it has to do with the multiplier effect. And we think it's an important part of the economy.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Some facts we can throw out as we meet people on the street.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is the discussion, continuing discussion of the principles. And again, I invite all the people from the audience that are going to be regular talkers or even a little irregular talkers, but are going to talk, to come down to the table and put your stuff down, and so that you can, we don't have to wait, and you can participate in the dialogue as it comes up without getting up and going away and all that. We were pretty good. It worked out pretty well last week. Of course, you don't get to get up and leave then, but you're excused if you have... if you have to get a drink of water or Coke or use the restrooms or whatever. Anyone else going to talk today about the principles? We're going on from page 11 where we left off. We're going to start with principle on the appropriate normal retirement ages. We're using the document of July 17th and July 18th. Mr. Martin?
Madam Chair, members, looking at the bottom of page 11 of the July 18th memo, this topic has to do with the appropriate normal retirement age. And the current principle talks about or contains two concepts that... the age for normal retirement should be set in a reasonable relationship with the limits on employability of average public employees, and it also indicates that there ought to be a differentiation between general public employees and protective or public safety employees. The two items that I noted that seem to be at variance to some degree in recent out of recent legislation, at least since the 1995-1996 reworking of the principles, was the shift in 1997 from an indexation of the normal retirement age to the Social Security age with a maximum of age 67. That was downshifted to age 66. And then in 2008, at least for the teacher plans, the blurring with respect to allowing reemployed annuitants in the extent that reemployed annuitants can earn salaries for active employment after they start drawing pension benefits. Beyond that, I've given you on page 12 the indication of the normal retirement ages for our various plans. And on page 13, I've suggested a modest or a slight shift in the principle. Some of it is stylistic, the shifting of the differentiation clause, the provision that suggests that there ought to be a differentiation between general employees and public safety employees, moving that up in the sentence in order to add a modifier to the reasonable relationship to employability limits portion of the sentence, that should not be at an age greater than age 66 for general employees. And my sense was by moving, by reversing the order of the sentence, it made it somewhat less cumbersome to read and understand. So the key add-on here is that not is it just the reasonable relationship to employability limits, but it's also not at an age greater than age 66 for general employees, reflecting that 1997 piece of legislation.
Senator Betzel.
I do have a question. The proposed change on page 13, I think, is the structure of the sentence, I think, makes it better that we do differentiate between the public safety employees who have low retirement age and then the reasonable relationship for everybody else. Of course, when we say, but not at an age greater than age 66, and that's to tie in with Social Security now, and if that changes again, does that put our principal out of compliance? We're presenting 66 because that seems to be what the number is right now, but that's changed over the last couple of years too, as you've noted, from 65 to 67 back to 66. So, do we want to lock into a particular age now, or just try to have some more general language that will still accomplish the same goal? And I don't know what to do there.
Well, Senator, before 1997, we indexed to a greater extent to Social Security, but we had set an age 67 upward end of that, no matter what Social Security did.
Okay.
The change in 97 was to further modify that upper end and not have 67, but have age 66 as the upper end limit. So we are indexing to Social Security, but not more than age 66. So if Social Security were to change again, that would not affect, if they were going to go to a later age, that would not change the principle. If Social Security were to go to a younger age, that would potentially, probably wouldn't cause any difference because then nothing would be later than age 66. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that the simple recitation I'm not sure that we've got a problem as a practical matter.
Any additions? Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, just the view that the principle should be more broadly drafted rather than specifying the age 66. I mean, that is what our current law states, but I'm not sure we need the specificity of age 66, but that's...
I sure wouldn't want it any later.
Right.
Senator Betzel? Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if what would be the impact if we, looking at the proposed amendment on page 13, if we just simply did not include the language at the end of line 4, but not at an age greater than age 66 for general public employees?
Just put a period after public employee on line 4.
I wonder if Mr. Martin would like to comment on that.
Mr. Martin?
Members, that would be a logical thing to do. My goal here was to try and contemplate or try and modify the principles in light of recent legislative changes, and that's what I was trying to capture. Obviously, a more general statement rather than a more specific statement adds more flexibility to your document, and I don't think it does any violence to the notion. Although you do seem to have, at least based on the fairly limited number of comments, some sense that age 66 is an upper end limit to your comfort level. And if that's in fact true, there's no harm in also putting it in the document.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Then, Mr. Martin, if that's done, then do you need to, then why do you need to move the interlineated sentence from below and tack it on above? Do you even have to do that? Why can you just strike what the senator said and leave the rest of it as is?
Representative Smith, I think observes correctly that there's probably no need that if you do away with the new language on page 13, lines 4 and 5, you essentially have the current principle unchanged, except that I've reordered the two clauses, and there's no grammatical reason to reorder the two clauses by if you do remove that new language. So I think leaving the principle alone gives you the same effect as suggested by Senator Lynch.
Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, I think moving the clause from the end of the sentence to earlier on does make some sense as far as sentence structure. I'm not sure, though, that we need the last clause that would be proposed. So I would move adoption on page 13, lines 1 through 4, but then place the period after the word words public employee, and just leave it at that.
Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Kahn.
No. It is now 67, isn't it, for socials, people who entered Social Security?
Yes.
And I guess I would support the Betzel motion. I don't think we should have a different age than Social Security.
All in favor of the Betzel motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Principle 2C5, appropriate early retirement reductions.
Members, on the bottom of page 13 is the current principle, which suggests that public pension plans should not subsidize early our retirement benefits, and except for appropriately designed early retirement incentive programs, retirement benefits should be actuarially reduced for retirement before any applicable normal retirement age. We have had some experiences where there is some subsidization of early our retirement. 97 and 99 in the public safety plans, a reduction that's other than the actuarial equivalent amount were put into place. The other change I note here on the top of page 14 is the 2008 change, which blurred the lines for retirement with the teacher plans allowing concurrent receipt to some extent of our retirement annuities and fairly significant public employment after retirement does make early retirement and how we're handling it somewhat more or less clear. The policy analysis proportion is on the bottom of page 14, a little bit on the top of 15. The change is in the middle of page 15. There's some reworking of the sentence to move it talks about unless there was a subsidized early our retirement age before the 2009 session, the current principle applies. And then I'm suggesting where the retirement plan had some subsidization before 2009, any further subsidy should only be enacted when required to achieve a uniformity or where unique policy considerations demand it. Basically recognizing that we do subsidize some things in the past and attempting to, in effect, put a stopper on the bottle.
Well, Madam Chair, of course, I don't know what the 2009 session is going to hold for us or what may be coming, but I think the principle that we try to adopt is one that is going to guide us and future pension commissions as we look at the issue, and I'm still trying to figure out, you know, I think that the principle as we had it, you know, does state a pretty good policy here that we should not subsidize early retirement benefits. And I'm not quite sure what the additional language would or could do, except to suggest that maybe around 2009, you know, we decided to change from that. And I'm not quite following that. So. So what I'm saying is, I'm comfortable with the principle as it is. If there's some modifications or to explain some deviations we've had, you know, I'm certainly open to doing that. But I'm not quite sure whether this needs much change. But
Senator Lynch,
Madam Chair. I appreciate Senator Betzel's comments, and I would tend to concur. I think that the principle as it's stated in its current form does adequately and appropriately address the principle that I think the commission is most comfortable with and provides that guideline.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, I guess the first added line, though, reflects reality. Otherwise, it looks as if we're trying to go back on the subsidized. There's no intention to remove subsidies that we have in existence. The answer is we think we shouldn't do them. So I think the first line reflects that, whereas if you take without that first line, it looks as if we ought to go on a removal campaign, too.
Well, except, Madam Chair, of course, the principles are simply guiding things that we should have for us, and I think the whole purpose of this memo, which is rather extensive, is to point out that, you know, sometimes we've deviated from those principles, and it certainly is going, if we leave this principle untouched, people in the future are going to come with proposed legislation and saying, however, there is an exception here because you did so, you know, you did have a subsidized provision, you know, and so how does that square? And at some sometimes we just ask to say, well, we just looked at the unique circumstances that we had before us at the time. We saw the principle, but we, for whatever reason, decided to go with something different. That doesn't mean that these are inviolate. But I think we do recognize that there are sometimes, as you know, we have gone ahead with something regardless and that have not always paid strict attention to what the principal said, whether by intent or inadvertence, but that happens sometimes.
Mr. Koppler.
Madam Chair, members, I'm not entirely certain what meaning is intended here with the terms subsidy or subsidization. I mean, economics typically means that somebody pays for something that somebody else gets in terms of value. And if you have an early retirement offset that isn't actuarially equivalent to the total plan costs, in the end that's still going to roll into plan costs, and I think it's still going to be reflected in your required contributions when the actuaries get done estimating liabilities for the plan benefits and the special features that you have for early retirement for long service people, say under the rule of 90. If you weren't taking a full actuarial cost reduction in benefit on that member's benefit themselves and somebody else is presumably paying for it, I think that's a function of when that plan feature gets introduced, because if it's there from the beginning for the same cohort of members through their full career service, then they've all paid for that early retirement benefit in effect, and it would have been, if contributions were set adequately, it would have been captured. So I'm not entirely sure how the term is being used here or how it's understood.
Mr. Martin?
Members, I think the current principle, I think, tries to indicate that the pension plan should not be subsidizing early retirement benefits, that it should be the individual should have a full actuarial value reduction. That's the current language. So you could set an age 35 normal retirement age and have, hence, the entire pension plan subsidize, or the cost of it be fully encountered. But where some individuals can utilize an early retirement and take less of a reduction, that's at the expense of everybody else in the pension plan at large. You may end up funding it correctly, but is that a good principle to induce people to leave getting more value by retiring early than other individuals get retiring later?
Madam Chair, that sort of answers my question. I think it's clear what's meant. It's kind of it's a little bit of a circular concept, and it really kind of depends on the cycle over which you look at it. I mean, if it's a plan benefit feature to do something less than a full actuarial cost reduction to a member's benefit to give them an enhancement for longer service than, say, maybe a typical career service person under the plan, then it's just another benefit feature. And I guess I would stop short of calling that a subsidy if the contributions are set adequate to permit that alternative plan feature. But the principle itself is worth embracing. Mm-hmm.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, on behalf of the statewide plans, we agree with Senators Betzold and Lynch that the current statement really is a good guiding principle, and that if there is a reason to have something other than an actuarial reduction, those who are advocating it should have to provide support for that position to the Commission. So we believe it's a good guiding principle as it exists.
Senator Betzold?
I think we can just leave maybe the principle as is, although, you know, as I'm reading, the current language, public employee pension plan should not subsidize early retirement benefits. I suppose the word subsidize is still necessary and conveys what we're trying to get there, but I can't imagine there's other situations where somebody said, well, you're not subsidizing my early retirement. I just want to do it anyway. So, you know, should we say it should not be permitted? Does subsidize actually capture what we're trying to do? Before I move on, does the current principle really, cover all the situations that we could have before us, or could there be others that somebody could make an argument for that, they really fall outside of the principle because of, what they're trying to accomplish in getting early retirement? If there's nothing further, Madam Chair, I'm happy to just move on to the next one. But I just want to flag that as just something I'm not sure if the word subsidize really covers everything or not. But it may.
Principle 2C7. Mr. Martin?
Members, 2C7 is discussing adequacy of benefits at the time of our retirement. This is the principles were developed over a long period of time. I think the first rendition of some version of the principles was in a 1957 or 1959 report of the commission. And this was part of the first set of our principles, this topic was at least covered. The current statement of the principles is in the middle of page 15, and it has five parts that benefit adequacy requires that retirement benefits respond to changes in the economy. This, I think, is really a reflection of the change that was made in 1973 when Minnesota's statewide plans went from a career average salary as the base salary for calculating benefits to a final average salary, and the recognition that a career average salary does not particularly respond to changes in the economy that affect our retirees or people who are about to retire. B is that the retirement benefit should be adequate at the time of our retirement. We did have instances where benefits were not adequate, and there were consequently post-retirement increases granted after retirement, which tried to catch people up to make things our retirement. So the goal is that we should try and achieve adequacy at the time of our retirement. The high five is again referenced in Item C, and it does reflect an exception for local police or paid fire plans where there never has historically been the use of a high five, but a strictly a final average salary, actually an ongoing salary of a given position. D suggests that engaging adequacy 30 years is the right period of time to look at for minimum length of service to determine whether or to look at any measure of adequacy, and that item E. Adequacy is both a function of the public pension plan benefits and also any Social Security benefit that's earned by virtue of Minnesota public employment. Next couple of pages goes through a bit of a discussion about benefit adequacy notions from various sources, trying to give you a sense of the fact that or the developing notions that have occurred or are occurring in trying to gauge what constitutes an inadequate benefit. And then on page 19, I suggest some changes in the the principle for item A didn't seem to capture the individualized view that we undoubtedly had in trying to set that part of the principle. So this, rather than talking broadly about changes in the economy at large, just talks about economic changes that affect public employees. The change in C suggests that is a little more straightforward in suggesting that the high five is the appropriate measure for most final average salary determinations. D just I think is more grammatical or just fleshing out without a change in the actual concept in D. And again, E is talking about just adding the words combination, which is obviously implied by including the two sources of pension payments. Then F is a new item, which retirement benefit adequacy should be determined on the basis of a single life annuity. When you're determining adequacy, you have to figure out whether you're going to look at a joint annuity benefit that's payable to a primary retiree with some amount going to a survivor, or if you're going to do this on the basis of an individual, and then if there's a conversion to an optional annuity, that's done by the individual trying to assess what they wanted to do and what survivor protection they have at large. I think we always have looked at single life annuities when we've been determining adequacy. I think that's underlying the thinking that went into the development of the principles, but it never was stated specifically.
Questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, just a comment. It's, as Mr. Martin has indicated, I think A, C, D, and E, the changes that are offered there, I think generally are more grammatical in nature than substantive, and frankly I don't have a strong preference one way or the other, but I think that it's important to just recognize that and note that we're not really looking at anything that would constitute a substantive change in those areas.
Mr. Martin.
On page 20, I also have an alternative, which is the middle of the page on page 20, which basically reduces the adequacy statement down to three items rather than the current five, and really picks up on the two recent studies, the one we're currently engaged in and the one that took place in 2006, where the measure of adequacy that's explicit or implicit in the studies is comparability over various types of pension plans nationwide. And so the alternative statement indicates that benefits should be adequate based on a comparison with the relative competitiveness of our benefit plans for the same type of employee in a national market. So if that measure of adequacy is something that you believe is the primary or best measure of adequacy, the alternative is laid out on page 20 in the middle of the page, tries to capture that.
Madam Chair, just on that point, in the long run, I don't know whether high five is you know, should continue on forever, and you know whether there's better ways to determine pensions. It's you know, I think we need to, you know, have some flexibility, you know, to determine where society is going, where we want to go. I don't think I'm ready to take the leap, though, to start making national comparisons, because then we're going to spend a lot of time in here saying, well, this is what people get in New York and Washington and California. Others are going to say yes, but here's what they pay in New Mexico and Nebraska. And at some point, we just have to, you know, keep it within our borders and say, well, let's just pay attention to what's going on here. And we appreciate knowing trends, but at some point, this could go into a direction we probably would regret if we went there too soon. And I don't think I'm quite ready to do that yet.
Maybe after our study.
After our study, yeah. Right. Let's study it. But I do agree with Senator Lynch that I think the proposed changes through E are fine, and I think that actually F does, you know, indicate what has been the practice, that we determine benefit adequacy on the basis of the single life annuity, although does that also capture the fact that people have choices when that, because you can choose to reduce the annuity if you want to, you know, provide coverage for others. And I think that says so, but is somebody going to take issue with that the single life annuity, you know, has some variables in here as to whether or not it is adequate?
Ms. Hacking.
That's a choice. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I think we agree with the comments being made here. I think we'd prefer to stick with the structure that you have in the original principle, and we offer just a couple of comments under E, the clause E of this. Question is really whether you want to introduce the concept of personal savings as also contributing to retirement security, because typically it's a three-legged stool of Social Security, the public pension, and then savings, income from savings. But that's just kind of a question we would raise. And we would agree that trying to measure adequacy based on interstate comparisons doesn't really make a lot of sense. That may be something you want to look at to analyze our competitiveness, but it's not really related to the concept of adequacy. So we like the structure that really is in the original principle.
Okay. Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice, Minneapolis Police and Fire Relief Association. Just a general comment, that I think Mr. Martin does a real excellent job of outlining the academic research about what the appropriate kind of replacement ratio should be. And I think clearly you want to factor in Social Security in Minnesota, so I think that argues for maintaining the working off the current section or the current principles rather than going to this national study. I do want to make a comment that the main reason for the review of this, Mr. Martin cites in his memo on page 15, is the 2001 legislation for the Minneapolis firefighters, my client, and then he cites two studies that the commission is doing just on benefit adequacy, the one from 2006 and 2008, which the chair alluded to and Senator Betzel did, that you're now going out looking at national studies to say should we do it or not, and I would urge the Pension Commission to proceed slowly and then rather going to the alternative, just wait and see what you come up with on that. But then going back to the 2001 fire one as the basis to have a whole review of this, I'd remind the Commission that basically there's an exemption for relief associations not only in this policy but a later policy. I think the 2001 legislation was well considered. It only affected about a dozen people, I think. So it was a pretty limited nature. And I'd also point out in Minneapolis Police and Fire, the Relief Association, the basic benefit, they don't have Social Security. The pension, basic measure of their pension is 50% of the current top patrol salary. And if you read this literature, the POC is more like about 80% is what you need as a benefit replacement. My clients, who are now very old, and I've been doing this for 25 years, and I've become more aware that really the people I'm representing, the average age is around 73, they're a very vulnerable group of people. I mean, they're older, they're not as active as they used to be, there are fewer, hardly any active members remaining, and you know, their economic circumstances changes quite a bit, and they have special needs. And I think that was indicated in the 2001 legislation. It's been indicated in some other things that we've worked on. And, you know, my clients, I think, are particularly unique. They don't have the same formula. They really are, you know, there's apples and oranges. Well, these are apples, oranges, and tungsten steel, I guess. They're just really a whole group apart, and that's why the exemptions are in the principles. I worked with Representative Jefferson 12 years ago so that that was understood. I don't think the change done in 2001 that the Pension Commission violated any of its policies, because the policies basically said you could consider that group as a freestanding group, and it didn't set policies for other ones. And then going to page 19, I think Senator Lynch, you know, did accurately say, at least with, and I'd agree with her comments, that changes for B, C, and D and E were really grammatical. I do think that if you're going to look at any changes on A, I think that the current policy is benefit adequacy requires that retirement benefits respond to changes in the economy. That's the current policy. I think that's a practical and good one to have because the economy can change. I think Senator Betzold said something a few years ago when you were talking about the whole post thing. You know, there were problems. How do you fund this? And, you know, the legislature came up with a response in the 90s about letting retirees have excess investment returns. You know, I think it made sense at the time. Experience has taught us maybe that wasn't the best thing, but then the commission responded and made some changes, you know, and shut that off and still trying to grapple with it. I think that having economic changes as something that you do respond to, even for your retirees, is an important one. And where I see the changes that Mr. Martin is suggesting here is that benefit adequacy requires that retirement benefits respond to economic changes that affect public employees prior to retirement. You know, my concern is that the group of people that I represent are really all retired now, and we'd hate to have that change in principle say, hey, you know, your chance to respond to any benefit adequacy happened at the time you retired. All your people are retired. You know, we don't want to hear your story about what's going on in the economy today. Because you can have high inflation, low inflation, good investment growth, poor investment growth. I think that if you, and maybe I don't have that right, but at least as I sit here and read it, that makes me a little bit nervous. I think the current language in A is better. It's more broad. And, you know, I think you always want to have, this commission always want to have, has the ability to just look at on a case-by-case basis. My only other comment would be with F, I don't know that I really understand that well enough. Retirement benefit adequacy should be determined on the basis of single-life annuity. I think that all of these studies do tend to talk about what a person needs to make. The model really currently is that you have a married couple. What does it take to provide for them? What's the appropriate replacement ratio? In 2001, the case I dealt with, there were older, for lack of a better term, bachelor firefighters who didn't marry, didn't have surviving spouses, and felt, well, the fund is giving more money to people who were married and less to people who weren't, and they were looking for some measure of fairness, I guess. I think we made the case to the legislature. It was a pretty modest increase. It affected 11 members, and it was a one-unit increase, which was about $1,000 a year or $1,000 in current times. And I think that it was, appropriate to do it. And again, I would say, at least in the group that I represent and why we frequently come over, we have a model that says it's 50% of the current working member. And if in fact, the benefit adequacy measure with public pension plan, Social Security, is more like around 80%, which is kind of what the academic literature Mr. Martin has cited, that's why, you know, we're frequently over here, because our model is different. And we've tried to do things to make it, you know, 13th checks, PRBs, some other issues that make it work for our members, because clearly we're in a time now when inflation is back, gas prices, food prices, health insurance. I mean, it's really hard for this older group of people to deal with, and we really need the legislature's help. We need to make sure we can present our case, you know, economic circumstances, you know, change. And the days of thinking inflation is going to be real tame, 2 or 3%, boy, we could be in for some really big shocks here all the way up and down the line, and retirees get hit by it. I do think it's an interesting subject. Mr. Martin points out now that kind of the definition of adequacy changes. You know, maybe the first decade it's one thing because people retire, they're still active, they travel, they do things, but then they get older and their lifestyles change and they move, and people are living longer. So anyway, those are my thoughts. I to sum it up, I guess I'd say I think the technical changes Mr. Martin makes in B through E are good. I would prefer you keep A the way it is, and I don't see the need for F.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. And we'll be talking more about the post-retirement things next week, mm-hmm. or next meeting, because that's the next principle.
Madam Chair.
Sam Betzel.
Returning to subparagraph A and some of the comments that Mr. Rice has made, I think we have to be a little bit careful to make sure that, you know, if we were to keep the A as it currently reads, that somehow isn't interpreted to say that the adequacy determines on what the economy is doing. Because those of us who were on this commission during the 90s, when the economy was white hot and the stock markets were doing extremely well, then we had a lot of requests for benefit increases simply because the stock market was doing well and there was surpluses and people could afford it. But we shouldn't be giving out increases during a good economy any more than we should be doing cuts during a bad economy. I mean, it's got to even out at some point. So I think whatever principle we have has to recognize that the adequacy should relate to the individual's status, you know, and whether it's prior to retirement or afterwards. And the adequacy is not depending upon what the economy is doing. And I think that there's a way you could read that principle as it is now to say that, hey, if the economy is doing well, give the increases, because that's what adequacy might mean. And that's I think we learned that that is not a very good idea.
Madam Chair, I would agree with what Senator Betzel said. I'm not trying to get to interpret this another way. I think that I would agree with you, Senator Betzel, that I think you want to set a decent benefit level and you have to phase out what the economy is doing. But the concern is that in the 70s, in the 60s, I had two great aunts who retired and they had really good civil service jobs. If they retired about 1967, 68, and then inflation came and really just wiped out their pensions in the 70s. And so I think the commission would want to stay. And I think that, you know, the commission did in those cases tried to respond to them, but it was kind of difficult. Inflation really eroded the value of pensions, and then there was a lot of catching up to do. There were strategies that employed. The economy got better, and one way to do it was, you know, investment gains, and that proved to be a challenge too. So I think it's I would agree with what Senator Betzel's comments are. It's my concern was more that the last clause that affect prior to retirement, so that it's like you just freeze it there. That's my concern. Because I think the one thing we have learned through this up and down is that you really got to say, let's be realistic here, what's a fair benefit? And if you get too enamored with the stock market investments, it can lead to some real inequities like you've seen with the cohort that retired in the 90s and saw the big run-up, and now the group that's retired in the last 5 years, and there's a big fairness problem there.
It indeed is. Mr. Fleming.
Madam Chair and members of the Commission, Morgan Fleming, I help the SEIU and middle management on pension and other matters from the legislature. But I'm here because with the passing of John Brandel brings to mind the 1987 session. And he normally wasn't maybe an author, not the chief author of a pension bill, and he was. And Todd Otis was the author in the House, and addressed all these issues because he was close to many retired Minneapolis teachers, no surprise, Violet Guyman and many others. And when Francis Perkins, when Social Security started in 35 or 6, there was never a means test. It didn't cover some people and never covered teachers till a long time. And there were many Minneapolis teachers retired that received no Social Security. We're living on $2,000 or $3,000 a year. So he came to Harry Adams, executive director of the committee of the Minneapolis Teachers Pension Fund. You should do something about it. He was really aggressive with us. So the fund spent a lot of time, their actuary, Mercer Meininger Hansen, restructured the benefits for their annuitants. They traded in the 13th check, which they'd had for many years, and gave its, Mr. Martin would remember, and gave its actuarial equivalent cost and some benefit changes. And one of them was, is what John Brandel called the floor respectability. So if you were a teacher that basic, that didn't receive Social Security, instead of getting $2,000 a year, you would get $3,000 a year per 10 years of service, so you could get up to $9,000. And it was funded. We didn't have great actuarial costs because the lives weren't long. They were elderly already. So the point I'm making here, I don't know if this is the appropriate time to talk about it, that the commission, the legislature, has been facile on these matters when there was something that wasn't reasonable or fair. They demanded that it be funded, and it was, and that was a success. But for the curiosity of John Brandel and being earnest, it wouldn't have happened. So point I'm saying is these are all great things, but there's always something you don't think about, and maybe there's some group, constituency, annuitants or other today in Minnesota that aren't treated fairly, and to be open-minded about it. Thank you.
And we want our principals to be able to include situations like that. Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to echo what Ms. Hacking stated on E, some mention of personal savings in addition to the pension plan and Social Security, I think would be something to consider.
Thank you.
And add with the personal payment, personal.
Madam Chair, it goes back to the three-legged stool. You've got
right.
The Social Security, the pension, and then personal savings being another important piece of what is important for measuring an adequate retirement.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a, perhaps maybe as a means to move us forward, I wonder if we could consider on page 19 the adoption of the amended language in C, D, and E with the understanding that we have perhaps further thoughts to give to letters A, excuse me, and letter F. So, Madam Chair, I'm suggesting that we adopt the amended language in C, D, and E.
And Madam Chair, although it does sound like there's a suggestion that E might need a little massaging, too, we might have to spend some time to discuss whether the personal savings ought to be added and as a consideration for one of our principals. So that's just one of the things that has been brought up here. So I haven't heard any problems with anybody on C or D at all. So, and we're getting kind of shy of our quorum here, so.
Don't count.
Don't count too well, yes. Okay. Right.
Don't ask yourself.
Yeah, I hear you.
Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, in light of Senator Betzel's comments, I would move the adoption of the amended language on page 19, letters C and D.
Any further discussion? Mr. Rapp, you wanted to talk about this principle.
I represent, I'm Ed Rapp, and I represent Education Minnesota Retired, and I have to always emphasize that. We're the other guys. But I'm here only to talk about teacher retirement. I'm here because back in 06, I walked out of a meeting of this group with 100, I think, 7 pages, legal-sized, that was instructing some committee of some sort to come up with recommendations on the adequacy, among other things, but on the adequacy of our pensions as compared to other states. So I went around and I testified at some committee hearings and so on, and every time I brought up the subject, no one wanted to hear it. And then I see in 08 you mandated it all over again because nobody did it between 2006 and 2008. But I really would like to talk just for a couple minutes, and I will get out of here quickly, about the adequacy. And I was just sitting back about 2 weeks ago reading the latest Money magazine. I consider it my wish book. And I was noticing that the number one best place to live, that's what it says on the cover, the number one best place to live is Plymouth, Minnesota. And, of course, that gives me a lot of pride, but over the years, this goes back to in the 80s, in fact, I think 70s, where money has come up with this best place to live, and a lot of Minnesota people have walked off with it. But the good news is number one is here. In fact, of the top 50 best places, 6 come from Minnesota, and 5 of the 6 got that ranking number one because of education, and the other one was only number 2, education. That's the good news. Bad news, Representative Murphy, is that Hermantown didn't make the list at all.
Yes.
Actually, 7 of the 8 top 100 were suburbs of the cities, and I don't think that's fair, Rochester being the other one who's won it a few times already themselves. But the point was for education. Education was the number one reason. Now, why am I here? Talk about pensions. How do we stand there? Are we number one in the country on pensions? No. As a matter of fact, way back in 06, I saw Education Minnesota had a big addendum to your report, and it appeared we were the worst. And I went back and checked it because somebody said, no, we're only second from the worst. And I can't find a worse one, and if anyone knows which state it is, I'd like to visit them and kind of snicker at them. But in pensions, we're the worst. We're entirely the worst, and there's a lot of reasons for it. I went to these meetings of the big three, only one of who is sitting here now, because the other two of whom are sitting there, because the other two aren't really concerned with it. And all we wanted to talk about was caps. All they wanted to talk about was the strength of the fund. Well, I remember every month looking at my TRA sheets that came out, and I never once said, oh boy, look how strong the fund is getting. I kind of looked at it as if I was getting something, a pension. And I was paying for it, and I was paying big. And I paid Social Security besides, and I paid it big. And then I find out that Social Security says they're in trouble, and TRA says they're in trouble, or even all the pension funds, and then they both have the same solution. We'll blame the beneficiary. The beneficiary can pay for it. Well, we didn't borrow the money from Social Security. It wasn't in a lockbox, and it was borrowed by someone else. And we didn't lose any money in the stock market, not a nickel, because we don't have one thing to say about it. I was told in 30 years of negotiating that that pension fund belongs to us, and any improvements the school district had to pay, we had to pay and count as part of our raise because we owned the fund. And then I retired and find out the state owns the fund. The state decides where we invest the money. The state makes every decision on our money, only now it's not our money anymore, it's the state's money, and the state's fiduciary responsibility is not to us, the beneficiary, although it says in the law it is, but to the state. We have no voice in our own money. And we had the worst pensions strictly in the country, the very worst. And the reason is not because we don't put it in, because frankly, we rank in the middle of the whole country on employee contribution. We only rank on the bottom on employer contribution. So I'm here to say, on behalf of Education Minnesota Retired, that we want to see improvement. And we're willing to pay our share for it. In fact, we do have a program, part of our legislative program, that says point blank, we have a way to pay for it. We're not just expecting a bailout from the state, but we are kind of expecting something from the state, even a plaque or an award that says, thank you, teachers. And as we look around at the other two major pension groups, we see that they have a considerable amount of self-determination. Some of them are getting a better deal from the state of Minnesota, and certainly they're getting a better deal as far as being able to determine for themselves how they spend their money. And we're here to ask, why not? Why can't we have that too? And that's all I have. I just came here to gripe.
Thank you, Mr. Rapp. In both the principles and the study, that's the questions we're asking. Sarah Lynch renews her motion to approve the language on page 19 and C and D. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. That concludes our discussion of the principles for today. At the next meeting on September 17th, we will continue with the discussion of the principles, and we will do at least three, maybe four. The next three, possibly four. So read ahead.
The next chunk.
I'm trying to decide if we can have just two chunks left or if we have three chunks left. But today we did really well. Sarah Lynch?
Madam Chair, on September 17th, what time will that meeting begin?
10 o'clock.
Okay. Right?
We didn't say so.
From 10 o'clock to 1 or so. There's one more group here that isn't really part of the study, isn't yet, and isn't really part of the principles, but what they're asking for, we talk around it a lot. There was a bill, Representative Kalin had a bill this year, and we've talked about it the last time, where one group wants to expand into another group, and they came prepared to talk today, and so we will give them a brief opportunity. They didn't get a chance to talk on Representative Kalin's bill, and so we'll get a brief opportunity for them to put their foot in the door. And so we all can hear what they have to say and what their request is, and their justification for their request. Please come forward, probation officers. On behalf of the Probation Officers Association, is it?
The Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers.
County Probation Officers.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so you work for the counties.
And the Minnesota Correction Association.
And the Minnesota Correction Association. You work for your county employees?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. and you supervise or you interview or you advise the people that leave the state correction facilities. Am I correct? Or the county jails?
That's correct.
Or both?
Both.
Okay. So you work for the people that have spent time in the county jails, or with the people that spend time in the county jails who have been arrested and tried and convicted, and the people that have been arrested, tried, and convicted and served their time in the state prisons and the county jails.
That's correct.
All right.
That's correct.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jeremy Reinhardt. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers. I'm also representing the approximately 1,200 probation officers in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of our request to consider an early retirement age for probation officers who really are public safety agents, but as of today are not included in a public safety plan. Specifically, we're not seeking to create a new and/or separate plan for the approximate 1,200 probation officers, but we rather request that accommodations can be made within PRA or the corrections plan, as outlined on page 13, the principle on page 13, which recommends different retirement age for regular public employees and protective and public safety employees. Getting back to the corrections plan, which was adopted a few years ago, it's important to note that we do supervise essentially the same offender that those corrections employees supervise. We supervise them before they go to prison, and we supervise them after they're released from prison. And I would argue that we supervise them in a more dangerous nature situation because they are out in the public. They have many more resources available to them. I also, because I work in Pine County, I represent the rural areas of Minnesota. The gentleman to my right represent metropolitan areas. We have a very vast area in Pine County. We have a Native American reservation, and we supervise that population as well, along with those individuals that don't appreciate the government very well, such as Posse Comitatus and other paramilitary compounds that we have in our area. Those people whom we supervise don't even recognize our laws. They are a significant risk to agents. I myself have had my life threatened. I've been told that if I step on the property, they're going to shoot me. Yet we still have to supervise those people, and we have a duty to protect the public from those people. Also, we have increasing caseloads that are very demanding. We've had many unfunded mandates that we now have to follow. As our caseloads increase, the danger increases as well. It's also, I'd like to point out that because we are supervising people in the community, we are subject to those people identifying who we are in the community as well. The offenders whom I supervise see me getting into my vehicle each day. They're able to know, what I drive. Know where I live. I run into these people in the community, at church, at the grocery store. They're able to identify who my family members are. And my wife and my children have been threatened in the past. And so we face many of the same dangers that the people in the corrections plan face, and I would argue even more so. I think with that, I'll pass it on to my colleagues here.
Senator, I do have a question. Are you saying the threats are coming from the people that you supervise?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, then another follow-up. You do have the opportunity, I would think, if these people are on probation, the offenders, that means they've still got some time over their head. So if they violate some of the terms of the probation, they go back to jail or prison. Is that the consequence they face?
Yes,
Mr. Reinhardt.
Member Betzel.
Okay, so if somebody threatens you, is that a violation of their terms of their probation?
Yes, Senator Betzel.
Okay, thank you.
Could I, yes. May I add to that? It has happened before, and just within the last couple of months, in which the offender was charged with new offenses for attempted assault on me in our office because I was confronting him on his recent chemical use. He stated, I've got nothing to live for. I lost my house. I've lost my family. I'd just as soon go to prison. And thankfully, I fell back on some of my verbal techniques to de-escalate the situation and tell him that, you know, hey, nobody's going to jail here. Let's just relax. He sat down, eventually sat down in the chair. I got him out of the office as quickly as I could. Notified the authorities. The authorities, then ended up having an assaultive situation when they tried to take him into custody. So that's just one example.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Jeff Kapler. I represent Hennepin County Intensive Supervision. I'm on the opposite end of what Jeremy's talked about. He handles the probation side. I'm in a division on the parole side. I've worked in the county for 16 years. I've worked in the institution. I've worked on the probation side. And as I mentioned, I currently work on the parole side in intensive supervision. What sets us apart in intensive supervision from traditional parole is that we handle the highest risk public risk monitor cases that there are in the state of Minnesota. Briefly, that encompasses, for my caseload, individuals that have been released on a murder charge or conviction, assault one, assault two, and I deal a lot with individuals that are highly connected in gangs in and around the Twin Cities area. Most of our work is in the community. We are actively involved in an intense mode with dealing with these individuals, and it presents a lot of risk being in the community. I have more stories than we have time for today, but to give you an idea and to kind of maybe even answer Senator Benzel's question from earlier, I did have an incident just over a year ago in which I entered a home at about 4 in the morning, and it was a required contact we had to make. And the short story is, as I walked into the house, an individual who answered the door shut the door behind me, and 6 feet from me was an individual with a shotgun pointed at my head. And that incident happened so fast, you really have no time to think or react. And as the saying goes, your life flashes before your eyes. That moment I did have that happen to me. This individual was arrested immediately and was at a hearing. At the hearing, he was revoked and sent back to the institution. However, he was released as of recently this past June. And in my own opinion, if there was ever a case for an individual to be revoked for the rest of all their time, this would have been the case. This individual was never charged with pointing a loaded shotgun at me. He was released. He was released to a halfway house, and while at the halfway house, he began threatening staff there and was terminated from the halfway house. He again went to a hearing. Only at this hearing, he was restructured, which basically means he was released and given a second chance. He was released to his mother's residence in North Minneapolis. 2 weeks later, when I was out in the community, I ran into this individual as I was making my rounds, shocked to see that he hadn't been revoked for the remainder of his time, and shocked to think that he went from a halfway house now back into the community. Today, he is a fugitive on the run. He ultimately absconded from this residence and has been a fugitive for several months now. So my point, I guess, is there is a lot of significant risk in this field. I could talk even more about experiences I had, even in probation, individuals with loaded guns that came into the government center many years ago. And I'm only one voice. There are several individuals in our unit who could share very comparable stories. Several individuals all throughout probation, parole, could share stories that mirror the one that I've just shared here today. I thank you for that opportunity to do that here today.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Dan Larson, and along with Mr. Kaplan, I am also an ISR agent in Hennepin County. Unlike the two gentlemen to my left, I am eligible to retire under the rule of 90 because I was hired prior to 89. And my main concern, I guess, would be those younger members that have to work until they're 70, 75 years old in this population. And that is my concern. Thank you.
How many probation officers are we talking about? How many are there?
Madam Chair, approximately 1,200. I do have a handout that.
And how many of the 1,200 are under the rule of 90? Do we know that?
Madam Chair, I don't know that answer.
Okay. Do we know? Mr. Larson, under the rule, you are eligible for the rule of 90, but you didn't jump out?
I'm not there yet.
Oh, you're not there yet. You're going to be
there. I will be there.
Okay. And on that day, are you leaving?
Hopefully.
Okay. Will that be 33 years?
It'll be almost 33 years, correct. I have 11 years left.
Okay. So what did you, when we were talking about the principles and we got to the principle that said 30 years, what did you think about that? Any one of you?
Madam Chair, so the 30 years would be a significant reduction for me. I've got 11 years experience and I'm age 35, so...
Have you spoken about this with the AMC, Association of Minnesota Counties?
Madam Chair, we've had ongoing conversations with AMC.
And what did they say about
this issue?
Your proposal.
I don't know the answer to that at this time, Madam Chair. We've had continual conversations. I guess we haven't heard anything negative specifically back from them. I don't know that they would say that they support it.
Or how would they fund it? How would they fund their share? Have you talked about that?
I don't think we've gotten that far, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Mr. Larson, what would be the ages of some of the people that... are coming out. You said people have to work to 70 to 75, and I did some quick math. I suppose if somebody started to work it as a parole officer at age 60, you know, by age 75 you'd get the rule of 90, but I can't imagine people are starting this profession at age 60. I mean, it would be younger people going in. How would people have to work to 70, 75?
Well, there's a lot of agents that are coming in, Hennepin County at least, are not getting hired until they're about 30 years old. Most of them are working outside the field. They're getting their education first. They don't have the experience to come in as a probationary officer right away. So they work in security positions. They work as guards somewhere else, and then they come into probation from there. I started at the age of 27.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Kahn.
The question I was going to ask is partially answered by the handout, which tells us what other states and the federal government does, but it only targets states in the Midwest. I wondered if we could have a more complete... I mean, are we unique in states in not having parole and probation officers having an earlier retirement option?
Do you know that?
Madam Chair, to the best of my knowledge, in our surrounding area, as it's sort of outlined in this handout, there is none, and I guess that does make us unique in that we don't have the rule of 90 any longer or any other, retirement options early.
Ms. Bennett.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, when Mr. Bergstrom was charged with doing a study several years ago, we did ask the National Association of State Retirement Administrators to give us some analysis on in which plans these types of positions were covered, and so we'll go back and look up that data and get it to you. We recall it was all over the place between those who had the same benefits as public safety officers and those who were in the general employees plan in various states. So, but we'll look that up and get it to you.
Well, thank you very much for coming today. You have made the initial presentation. If I remember correctly, when the nurses went into the plan, that took like six sessions. So you'll probably be in your 40s then. But we'll see what happens as we go along. And you've gotten a place in our minds now. So as we're proceeding with the study and talking about the costs and how the various costs would be paid for if there were different benefits, we recognize the fact that many people, there's more now that don't have the rule of 90 than do have the rule of 90, and that some people are going to leave as soon as they can. We certainly understand, those of us on the Public Safety Committee certainly understand the dangers of the job, and we appreciate your service, and we will continue to discuss this.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other business to come before us? September 17th, the demographer will be here. Some fiscal people will be here. Association of Counties will be invited. That's for the study part. And then we will do for sure the next three principles, maybe four. Thanks for coming.
See you.
Thanks for your input. This meeting is adjourned.
See you in September.
Good work.
Well, thank you.
I'll be real ID at that moment. I'll be passing through your district on our annual.